Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Monday, July 27, 2026, and this is episode 128. It has been a warm and unusually wet July here in Nashville. I am told by Claude that the normal rainfall in July in Nashville is about 4 inches. Up to today, the rainfall total would be between 6 and 9 inches here in Nashville, depending on your location. This is generally good news for gardens and forests, which have been close to a drought situation for quite some time. Anyway, things are certainly green here at home, and it is a challenge to keep up with the weeds. As we get started today, let me remind everyone that the podcast is available on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts. Apple has recently added a function of providing a transcript of the interviews, which is a really nice feature. One of the rewarding things about doing this podcast is that I get to share with you my various interests and life experiences, and of course, the wonderful people I meet along the way. Beth and I have been fortunate to be able to travel a good bit, and this spring we had an outstanding visit to England, and most notably, the county of Cornwall, in the southwest of England. Our visit there was prompted by an exploration of the history of Beth's Killebrew ancestors. This is an exquisitely beautiful place and jam-packed with history. My guest today is Bobby Inman, a native of Tennessee, now living in Falmouth, Cornwall. The first American-born town crier of the town of Falmouth. Bobby and his partner have a business called Falmouth Uncovered, which offers history-based tours and interpretation for visitors to that area. Bobby is like a ranger interpreter, but for a whole town. We had the privilege of spending the better part of a day with Bobby, exploring Falmouth and learning about his remarkable history. And so I thought it would be fun to let you meet Bobby and share with you his enthusiasm for sharing history with others. And so I hope you will enjoy this conversation with Bobby Inman. And we will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish 6 beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
So, Bobby Inman, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really honored. Thank you for asking me.
Just to set the stage, Bobby, this is so fun. I'm speaking from Nashville, Tennessee, and you are presently in Falmouth in Great Britain.
Falmouth, England. Yeah, that's right. Right on the southwest coast, almost as far southwest as you can get in the country of England.
Right. And I should say, my wife and I were visiting with you back at the end of April, the beginning of May this year. And we just had a wonderful time in Cornwall. And the trip was made very, very special by getting to meet you and to find out about what you're doing there. So I wanted to share with my audience a little bit about our visit and the fun things that happened there. And so Bobby, you are a native Tennessean living in England in Cornwall as you said, the southwest part of England. And I guess the question arises, how in the world did a guy from Roan County, Tennessee, get over there? Tell us about that.
Well, I get asked that all the time. And it's one of my favorite things to say. It's one of my kind of favorite stories. So I originally met a woman, and I moved to England 23 years ago. Most of my time in this country was in Plymouth. I where the Mayflower set sail from in 1620. And
not far away from where you are now, but
not too far at all. In fact, it's just one county north of here, right over the border. So you've got Cornwall and Devon, and separated by the River Tamar. And literally, when you cross the border, across the Tamar River and the Tamar Bridge, you are in Plymouth. And so I spent just over 15 years in Plymouth. And then, you know, circumstances happened and my marriage ended. And I had really fallen in love with Cornwall in my time in Plymouth. And so I kind of, it was almost a no-brainer. I knew where I was going for my fresh start. And I was living on the North Coast, and I met my current wife, Natasha, and she was living here in Falmouth. And so I was on the North Coast, she was on the South Coast, and so it just made kind of more sense for me to come here. She is a chef in a restaurant here, and so I moved to Falmouth just over 6 years ago.
So tell us about your growing up here in Tennessee.
Well, I grew up in Roane County, like you said. I'm from Kingston, Tennessee, just south of the river. And I spent a lot of time in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And that was part of Roane County has its fair share of kind of Native American history and things like that. But being surrounded by the Civil War history and then spending a lot of time in Oak Ridge, I developed a real fascination for history, you know, and Oak Ridge being part of the Manhattan Project, and kind of one of my favorite places was the American Museum of Science and Energy, and the whole bottom floor was about that secret city and the city behind the fence. Right. And so I grew up really fascinated with history and loving that. And then when I moved to this country, that certainly deepened with the richness and the depth of history here.
Tell us about your schooling. I know from meeting with you that you attended school at Middle Tennessee State.
I attended Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, not far at all from where you are. And I studied graphic design, really, and I was into art and that kind of thing. And when I first started university, it was all pencil and paper. And kind of my junior year of university, it was, we got our first art computer. And the shift was happening to computer design. And back then, you kind of had to make a choice. You had to pick, well, I'm going to stick with traditional medium, or I'm going to go to this new computer. And I liked computers, and I was online, but I saw kind of that side of it as more of a tool. And I didn't want my whole life to be on computers. And so I chose traditional medium. But I tell you, by the time my fourth year of university rolled around, it was obvious which way it was headed. And I realized kind of quickly that there was going to be very little room for traditional media after it all kind of shook out. We initially thought, oh, when it's all said and done, there'll be room for everybody. There'll be traditional medium and there'll be computer medium, and it'll all be one big homogenous happy family. And it became quickly apparent that that wasn't going to be how it went.
Well, you touched on your interest in history just a moment ago, and when you were talking about being exposed to all the circumstances there at Oak Ridge. And you've got a gig going on there in Falmouth right now, which really is totally focused on history.
It certainly is. And I tell you, one of my best kind of experiences with that this year is with you and your wife. It was such a great meeting for y'all to come over here, and your wife can trace her history back to exactly here in Falmouth and the founding family here. And so, yeah, I'm a tour guide here in Falmouth for the history and the ghost tours. But I'm involved in not just the tour guide stuff, but a whole plethora of tourism and hospitality-based kind of activities. But the history tour is something that I can really sink my teeth into in the summer, and it's something that I really get into. I had a history tour this morning with four people.
Yeah, well, let's let our listeners know about it. You know, you never know who may be deciding on a trip and may be looking for an activity. Your tour outfit is called Falmouth Uncovered Tours.
Falmouth Uncovered Tours. We run history and ghost tours here in Falmouth. And it was founded by my friend Will, and he kind of created the tours. And he started researching Falmouth and realized that nobody was telling the story. And Falmouth has a dynamic story, and it's a really interesting and relevant story. And it was an important port in the Northern Hemisphere for over 160 years. And its story is kind of undertold in many ways. I think it gets lost in some of the history of England. Some of the, a lot of England's history is centuries and centuries old. Well, Falmouth's just barely 250. And so it's, 450, sorry. And, right. And so it's a dynamic history, but I think, like I said, it sometimes gets swept away and lost within in a lot of the deeper history that exists here. When I was in Plymouth, I did I researched two history walks and a history podcast. And to pick out events for a history podcast in a town that goes back to the 1300s and even before is very difficult. Whereas as with Falmouth, it's almost condensed in a sense here. And so I really got into the history tour kind of stuff, and having y'all over here and having private groups, and the tours range from private groups with just a couple of people. And on Friday night, I had a ghost tour with 22 people. Wow. So
a ghost tour is really about ghosts.
Well, once again, because Falmouth is a new Cornish town in relative terms, it's not like nearby Penryn can trace itself back to the 1100s and before. And so every pub is haunted and every house has a ghost, whereas Falmouth isn't like that. And so really in the ghost tour, it's a history tour disguised as a ghost tour. We talk about the darker side of Falmouth's history. The last cannibalism trial of England began here in Falmouth.
Oh my gosh. We talk about
some murders that happened here. And so it's still a history tour. And we do get a couple of proper good ghost stories. And they're ones that are found in local legend and local lore. And so to have those kind of in our pocket as well as the historic side means we attract people who are interested in both the paranormal and the history behind the paranormal stories.
Well, Bobby, you're kind to reflect on my wife and I and my visit there with you. We had a remarkable time, and one of the things that we do in our travels, and we're lucky enough to be able to travel, thankfully, is we like to have the travel be meaningful in the sense of family history. And we chose to go to Cornwall because of Beth's family history. And it's a Tennessee history as well. The Killebrew family in Cornwall is very, very much part of the local lore. In Tennessee, the Killebrew family is the same family, we think. Beth's three times great grandfather was Joseph Buckner Killebrew, who was one of the founding commissioners of agriculture in Tennessee back just after the Civil War. Then they have a history in Tennessee, which involves mining and resources and those sorts of things. So when we travel, we like to pick places that have some sort of family connection. We've traveled to Ireland and to Germany and places like that, and have made family connections. So traveling to Cornwall was a natural for us. And do you get a lot of folks who are doing family history in your experience?
Not as many. I mean, we are contacted more often about it rather than people coming on the tours necessarily to contact us. And Will is known as somewhat of a local historian. So people contact him. One thing Falmouth has, though, not just with Will, not just with Falmouth Uncovered, is we have a deep history kind of archive. And there are people at the local independent cinema and museum, the Poly, and you can contact them about any question you have. And they will get somebody on it, looking through the archives, looking through the things that are in the town council offices or old newspapers. And so even without people that are official historians, there is a huge, vast network of volunteers and information seekers who are constantly being contacted about family stuff. And like with myself, I'm fortunate enough, I'm Falmouth Town Crier. And so I'm Falmouth's first official American Town Crier. And one of the things that kind of comes with that is wanting to learn about the history of the Town Crier. So I immediately got in touch with the Poly people, and they have, it's a brilliant table that they've produced with any mention or records that go back right to the 1600s. Because with Falmouth's history, it was a very heavily information and news port for a long time. And the Town Crier was very prominent back then. There wasn't a newspaper here in Cornwall. Even without newspapers, there were very few people that could read and write. And so the Town Crier was extremely prominent and daily given the news that he could glean from the ships coming in and out of the harbor. So I'm working on a kind of history of the Town Crier. And a lot of that is from this network of volunteers. And just putting out an email to say, hey, this is what I'm looking for. And within, you know, just a couple of days, I was kind of swarmed with people going, hey, we're on that. We're researching it.
We were very much welcomed by the groups that you mentioned. We visited the library and archives and the folks that you mentioned at the Falmouth Polytechnical Institute, and everybody was so welcoming, and we had communicated with them before visiting, so they were prepared in a way to speak with us, but very welcoming, and it made our visit so much more meaningful.
And that's really their goal. It's visitors and locals alike. They kind of, you see them all the time. They're here to help. And you've got the Poly, you've got the library, you've got the people at the Maritime Museum. You've got, you know, there's so much interest in history here that there's always somebody willing to help out. And it's a tourism-based town. It's a hospitality town. And so it's based around that, helping each other and being there for that kind of service.
Right. So let's it's been fun sharing pictures of our trip with friends as we've returned and have digested that trip. And almost without exception, people are surprised at the pictures and the beauty that's displayed in Cornwall. It's a magical place, just physically, and a beautiful place. As you well know, the Gulf Stream and the Atlantic, moving from south to north, brushes that corner of England and moderates the temperatures there and the climate there to a really outstanding result. You have palm trees occasionally on the landscape and plants and landscape features that you would associate with a much warmer climate.
Like the Lost Gardens of Heligan, there is a tropical jungle that is substantiated, you know, it's sustained by this climate here. It never gets very cold. I think this past winter, I don't think we had a single hard frost this past winter. And these temperatures that we're getting, I'm talking about, you know, we're having a warm spell right now and it's beautiful here, but this is unusual to be this warm. Usually the temperatures are, even especially down here on the coast, a little bit less than this. The humidity's not as bad as it has been lately, and so we don't go very much extremes. It's not a very hot summer, it's not a very cold winter. We do get more rain than most places, even in this country, even for a rainy country. We get a lot of rain here. But, you know, you look right behind me. I live on a boat, and so I'm on the water.
I can see you're in the harbor there. Yep.
I'm in the harbor, in the marina. And it's a beautiful day to sit out on the hull of your boat, or I'm in the wheelhouse right now, which is a little kind of greenhouse. And, right. You know, we've been going down to Green Bank, the nearby hotel, and going swimming as often as we can. And it's just been a really, this is why people live in Cornwall. And like you said, it's a magical place.
Right.
It's not just about the scenery, the people. It's an ancient history. It shares a Celtic history with Ireland and Wales. It had its own language. It was its own country for a while. It has its own flag. And they're very proud of that. They're very proud of that autonomy and independence, but also proud of the history, the Cornish history that is very specific, the mining that you mentioned. You know, Cornwall has its fingers in pies all over the world because of mining. And
well, there were a lot of Cornish miners that transported to the United States and other places around the world, Mexico and other places to do mining.
Yeah, Canada, Russia, right. All over the place, Alaska, New Mexico, Michigan, Virginia. You will right. find Cornish pasties in every corner of the world.
What is a Cornish pasty for those that might not know that?
So a Cornish pasty is a half moon pastry that is filled with meat and potatoes and swede and carrots. And so it's kind of a very hearty pastry. It's a savory pastry. And there's a lot of stories about it. It was a mining food originally. The miners kind of developed the Cornish pasty or adapted the Cornish pasty. The mining kind of community, half of it would be savory and half would be sweet. So they could have their lunch and dessert and eat it. There's some anecdotal stories that the thick crust was developed to absorb the coal dust from their hands so they could hold on to that while eating it and eat away the half moon. We don't know how truth that is, that they okay. probably actually washed their hands and just ate the whole thing. Okay. Because back then you wouldn't even waste the crust of a pastry. You would make sure you ate as much. You knew the work that went into that food and that pastry, and right. you weren't going to throw it out. And so right.
that pastry was loaded with lard and fat, and so you would want to eat that. Absolutely.
Absolutely. It was a heavy, yeah. It was a heavy pastry, and it's a substantial, stodgy is what they say here in this country. It's a stodgy meal.
Right. So we were in Cornwall at the end of April and the beginning of May, and I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, we were there really at the early part of your tourist season, maybe even before your tourist season began, and I found it wonderful because it wasn't crowded, the roads were, easy to travel, but I take it that it's a very popular place for English tourists to visit and can be very crowded at some times of the year.
Cornwall in general, especially places like St. Ives, Penzance, Padstow, these places that have international kind of appeal through television and movies or stories, those kind of things. And a lot of Cornwall is extremely seasonal. You're right. You were here right at the beginning of the tourism season, because we had started getting cruise ships here into Falmouth the 1st of April. That's when our first cruise ship came, was 1st of April this season. And the difference here is really that the school holidays, the summer holidays in particular, are very short. They have just now broken up school. This past Friday was their last day of school here, and that goes until September 4th, and so it's okay. just over 6 weeks is a school holidays in the summer.
That's way different than here.
Way different than America. Yeah. And so you'll have a holiday season that will go from April to October, but really it's only busy in that real middle 6 weeks when everybody's out of school, parents are bringing their kids down to the beach, that kind of thing. You can kind of go on either side of that, and like you said, you can find the roads are a lot more clear and the towns are not quite as busy, unless you come on a cruise ship day and there's 3,600 people walking through Falmouth, so it's a bit different then.
Right. So getting to Falmouth for us was part of the adventure. We flew into London, naturally, direct flight from Nashville, and then got on a train to go to Cornwall, which we went to Truro, which Truro. Is the cap. Which is, say it again,
Truro.
Truro, and it, which is the capital of Cornwall.
It's the only city in Cornwall, so it's not just the capital. It is the only settlement that has been declared a city. Everything else in Cornwall is either a town or a village or unincorporated. But it is the only city. Interesting fact: it's also the only city in England that's spelled only with letters from the second half of the alphabet.
Well, okay.
Random trivia fact.
There's a fact that I have to put back in my mind. The travel from London on the train was enjoyable. It was about a 5-hour train ride, and fast moving train, probably upwards of 75 miles an hour for most of the trip, I would say. Very enjoyable. We were able to rent a car there in Truro, and then from there travel around. I guess you could take a train to other towns in Cornwall as well. You can get into Falmouth on the train.
You can get into Falmouth on the train, and you can get to places like Parr and Penzance, Newquay. The train, between the trains and the bus, the public transport is very good. Okay. The thing about Cornwall, and I'm sure you found with Beth as well, that the lanes are very narrow. You don't have many highway. There's not a big highway network here in Cornwall. And so the transportation links are limited. And in fact, that's in some ways some of the appeal to Cornwall is because it takes a lot of people so long to get here that they don't come here because it's such a pain. And so, but it swings and roundabouts. There's balances to everything. It also stops major industry and a lot of job opportunities coming to Cornwall, which means it is a high cost of living area with very little sustainable income. It's there's not many kind of factory jobs or kind of those kind of positions. It is very much tourism and hospitality based. And you find a real juxtaposition with sometimes the people that come here versus the people that live here. It's a wonderful place. The transportation links can be somewhat of a hindrance, particularly if you live in Cornwall and you want to go to Manchester or London. If you're in London and you want to go to Manchester, it's an hour and a half train, or you want to go to Birmingham, it's a couple of hours. Like you said, if you want to come from Cornwall to pretty much anywhere else, you're looking at 5-6 hours on the train.
Right. Well, this was not a problem from our standpoint. It was a beautiful, beautiful train ride. And once we got there, we were able to rent a car. And, I'm not afraid to drive on the wrong side of the road, although the roads in Cornwall can be challenging because they're so narrow.
Yes, we say that as the roads narrower, and you might be on a highway, and then in 5 minutes you're on a little narrow lane, and my wife and I will look over at each other and go, the roads are getting Cornish, and that just that's the way to look at it. It's a lot of them are two ways but one lane, and so there's
right. At best one and a half cars width wide, and so. You just have to be prepared almost at any time to just pull over and let somebody pass.
And the highway code here, the laws are still in place that before you go around a blind curve, you are supposed to honk your horn. Not a lot of people do that, but every now and then you'll hear somebody honking their horn, and it's because they're coming around a hedgerow or a steep curve, and you do get a lot of those. And people talk about Cornwall all the time, and East Tennessee, with those rolling hills and sometimes dirt country roads, it's one of the things that I find very attractive to Cornwall, as it reminds me of home in some ways.
You know, we were able to travel to St. Ives. We made St. Maw's our home base for during our trip, and it was just a beautiful little town. And you could take
you chose well, yes, chose yeah, very
you
well.
Can, you can take a ferry over, you know, which is a 15-minute boat ride over to Falmouth, but then pretty much everywhere else you had to drive.
Yes.
And we were able to go to St. Ives on one of our journeys out. And now St. Ives is on the north coast of Cornwall, and it is a tourist destination.
Very much so, yes.
I mean, there's a beautiful beach there, a big strand of beach, maybe 10 miles long, and just white sand and clear blue water. I mean, it looks like the Caribbean, and an old picturesque English town up on the tops of the cliff there. Just a gorgeous place. In fact, but I can imagine though that in the height of the season, it would sort of be like Gatlinburg by the sea.
Very much so. Very much so. That and Padstow is another one, and Penzance. Those three are kind of notorious for, in the height of the tourism, it's wall-to-wall people. They are jam-packed.
Right. But worth visiting nonetheless, just because they're incredibly beautiful. The seaside village sort of aspect there at St. Ives, there's a harbor there. But the fluctuation of the tides from throughout the day is such that at times you'll see sailboats really just stranded in the sand there in what otherwise would be the harbor.
Yep.
Quite a beautiful place.
We all pay attention to the tides. Everybody that lives around the sea, a lot of things are governed by the tides. Like I said, my wife and I live on a boat. We have a small dinghy, a small tender, and we will take it out to our other boat that's moored up, or we'll take it to another cove. And we have to pay attention to the tides. If we're going to, we need to look tomorrow. Okay, let's check the tide times. Well, we need to be out of here by 10:30, and we need to be back by 1:30 to make sure that we're in and out before the low tide sets in. And that's that very minor example of so many different things. And I never really realized or understood how much the tides can affect things until I started living in a tidal town, in a coastal place.
Right. And I guess there's a serious beach scene there, people just going to the beach. But Bobby, the water's really cold.
The water is very cold. With this warm weather we've had right now, you're getting a lot of people out swimming. And my wife and I have been out swimming a lot, especially on some of the stone beaches. Because what's happening right
now... Tell me what you mean by that now.
So a stone beach, you know, with pebbles, there's a place called Castle Beach, and it's just, rather than sand, it's kind of stony, round, smooth pebbles.
Okay.
And the sun will be on those at low tide, low tide, low tide. And then as that slow high tide comes in, the water is warmed by those rocks that have been out in the sun all day. And so we are finding that some of the beaches right now are really warm, very, very inviting. And there's quarries and other natural kind of springs to that people, and they are being heated by this wall-to-wall sunshine that we've had for kind of weeks now. And so you're seeing the beach scene has been crazy here for a month and a half.
Well, I have to tell you, we were impressed even in April when we didn't see any days where the temperatures were above 70 much, but there were people. I mean, the sun was beautiful and the water was very inviting looking, was clear blue water, and the sun was so beautiful. It was inviting to try to get in the water, and people even then were swimming. The water temperatures were probably 55 or so.
We have people here that swim year-round. middle of January, February, December. There are water swimming, coastal swimming is a daily ritual for people here, and it has health benefits. They're starting to see kind of pop-up saunas right beside the beaches, and so they say getting in the cold water, then coming out to the sauna and back in the cold water, or back in the sauna is supposed to be very good for your health. And but people here swim every day of the year. It does not matter the weather. It does not matter the temperature. They are in the water.
And we saw some with wetsuits, but many without.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right. Just bathing right. suits and cold weather swimming, winter swimming. There's traditions on Christmas Day not so much, Boxing Day, which is the day after Christmas, and New Year's Day, you will find hundreds of people in the water. They are in there swimming, and it's a yearly tradition. We'll go down to Gilly Beach on Boxing Day, and you will see hundreds of people out in the water.
History of Falmouth is an interesting thing to study, as you have been doing over the last several years. I was impressed, Bobby, in your description of it, talking about the packet industry,
the packet service, and what a
focal point for that Falmouth was back in its heyday. Talk about that a little bit.
So in 1688, Falmouth was declared a packet station and part of the packet service. Now, this was really the first attempt globally at international mail. And along with letters and cargo and parcels, what Falmouth really became known for was diplomatic information. This was the height of colonization, people sailing to the New World, to both North and South America, to the Caribbean, and settling these places. In fact, there are 12 other Falmouths around the world, all named after this one, and many of them founded by packet captains or packet officers. And so the packet station that grew here in Falmouth became larger than all of the other packet stations in England put together. So it was synonymous with that mail service for 160 years. And the fleet that came in and out of this harbor was kind of legendary. You know, they were formidable captains and they were fast ships, and 40 to 60 of them every day in and out of this harbor. And it made Falmouth second only to London for news of the day. It was a very important port for information and for news and for diplomatic kind of relations.
Were these steamships or sailing ships?
These were sailing ships. In fact, okay. Steam, the invention of the steam engine, is what kind of cut Falmouth out, because before that, Falmouth is one of the great harbors of the world. It is the third deepest natural harbor in the world, and it's truly one of the great ones. It's surrounded by a lot of sides by land, and so it's a very sheltered harbor, very attractive harbor. And ships that were sailing up the coast to Southampton or Portsmouth or Plymouth, and the wind would be in the wrong direction, they would need to come in somewhere and seek safety until that wind changed direction. And Falmouth became that place. And so with the invention of steam, Falmouth lost its relevancy. No longer did you have to come into Falmouth. You could just, as long as you had enough coal, keep going up the coast. And so that changed Falmouth's destiny forever. So this was in the height of sail. And in fact, when that ended Falmouth's reign as that kind of hub in England.
Right. So just describe the harbor to us a little bit. I know that at the mouth of the harbor, so to speak, you have a big fort-like castle-type structure.
Well, and there's two of them. You mentioned earlier St. Maul's. Right. And so right across from each other, so the land kind of encircles a little bit, and then on the point of each land is a castle. Pendennis Castle and St. Maul's Castle, they are exactly 1 nautical mile from each other. So if you ever sail into the harbor, you have a really good view of exactly how far 1 mile is. And they were built to protect the harbor. So the land then goes around and comes out into, and then the town of Falmouth is here. And the harbor kind of splits and does two rivers. One kind of goes to the northwest and one kind of keeps going west. The west one ends in an ancient Cornish village called Penryn. And the other river goes up what's called Carrick Roads to Truro, where you spoke of. And so the harbor
itself. The Fowl River.
It is the Fowl River, and that
right.
part of it is known as Carrick Roads. And so we're in the mouth of the River Fowl, and that's
right.
where Falmouth gets its name.
Right. Very interesting. Well, Bobby, do you have any plans to travel back to the States?
I'm not. Tentatively, my mother's got a big birthday in January of next year, and she wants us to come back. I am traveling to North America in just over a month. I'm going to Canada. My wife's brother lives just outside of Toronto.
Okay.
With his wife and our 2-year-old nephew, and so we're going to visit their family and then go see some friends in Montreal. And so I'm really excited about my Canadian trip at the minute. There's a few places in America that I really want to take my wife. We got married in the Smoky Mountains in 2024, and so I got to show her East Tennessee and some of those places. But, you know, I'd like to show her New Orleans. I'd like to show her some of the Bayou, some of the Biloxi, kind of maybe Memphis. Some Mississippi River, Nashville. I really want to take her to Nashville. And so we still have a lot of North American exploration left to do.
Fun. Well, we'd love to host if you get a chance to come to Nashville. That'll be fun.
Oh, we'd love that. We'll take you up on that. My mom, I meant to, she came to Memphis. I meant to tell her as she came through Nashville to give y'all a holler.
Well, darn, absolutely. If she's traveling this way, just we'd love to see her.
I'll certainly let her know next time, certainly.
Bobby, I want to give one more shout out to the Falmouth Uncovered Tours, and I know that if you're on Facebook, you can find that listing and get in contact with you through that mechanism.
You certainly can. Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, or just Google Falmouth Uncovered, where we're kind of the first thing that comes up. And it's just a 2-man operation, and Will's the heart and soul of it, and I'm just honored. This is my third season with Falmouth Uncovered, and it's kind of my favorite thing to do every week is to take people around and tell them the story of Falmouth.
Well, Bobby, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Mark Fraley podcast, and thank you for joining me.
It has been my pleasure as well, Mark. Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be asked, and I've thoroughly enjoyed my time with you.
Thank you, Bobby. All right.
Hey, say hi to Beth for me. Y'all were, like I said, some of my favorite memories of this season, and I will cherish them for a long time.